And welcome to another episode of the Telltale Heart, a Cardiovascular Digest for Pharmacists. And I'm excited to bring a episode to you today that is a continuation of a conversation to a trial that we talked about post-AHA. However, I've had the luxury and the opportunity to know the lead investigator, and we've collaborated on a couple of things and events, and he and I started talking at a meeting one day and thought this, you know, he gave me some more insight into his particular trial, and it's really actually interesting in how we as pharmacists could help implement and serve our patients better today from this context. And before we jump into the episode, just a reminder, if you like our content, you know, like the podcast, subscribe, share it with your friends, send us feedback. If there's things you want to see or hear in future episodes, please let us know. We'll begin our ACC 26 coverage soon to prep for that meeting while we're still doing some content from this. So just continue to let us know what you'd like to hear about. With that being said, because I know everyone has eagerly to hear what we're going to have to say, I'm going to jump straight into the trial. And first, I'm going to introduce our two guests. So I'm going to first introduce Dr. Ambrose Pandey. He is a cardiologist currently in Texas. Do you want to tell him where you're at and what your practice is, please?
Sure. Thanks, Greg, for having me on this podcast. Hi, everyone. I'm Dr. Ambrose Pandey. I'm an associate professor of internal medicine and a clinician scientist at UT Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas, Texas. And I do a lot of work in the space of cardio-kidney metabolic disease and heart failure. So excited to be here to talk about some of our recent work.
Yeah, very good. Thank you. And I know he is very pro-pharmacy, and you'll hear that today with this process of the trial. And then his collaborator who helped make this trial that we've talked about and we'll talk about in a minute work is Dr. Nick Miller. He works at a compounding pharmacy. Nick, do you want to introduce yourself and where you worked and what, you know, kind of your background is?
Sure, Craig. Thanks. I'm Nick Miller. I work as a compounding pharmacist at a pharmacy called Pharmacy Solutions. We're located in Arlington, Texas, about 20, 30 minutes away from UT Southwestern, where Dr. Pandey's headquartered. And we do all sorts of different things, sterile and non-sterile. And one of the hats that I wear is helping to implement and execute investigational studies and trials. And so that's what we're here to talk about today.
Very good. It seems like there's been a long-standing collaboration, especially with both of you in relation to some of the trials that are going on. We'll get to that. So I first want to just turn the attention to the trial itself. You know, we've talked about both prior to the AHA, the poly-HF trial, and kind of what the design was. And then we also talked a little bit about the results afterwards. Now, I think, and Dr. Pandey, tell me if I'm still correct in this, the full results have not been published yet, correct? But your presentation is available from the AHA presentation, correct?
Yes, that's correct. Full research results have not been published in a peer-reviewed journal yet. They are in process of peer review. But the presentation from the American Heart Association meeting is available.
Yeah, and we can repost those slides. So just to summarize, tell us about, you know, in your own words, since I've talked about it, but since we have the actual lead investigator, what was your intent of the trial? What was the aim and kind of what was the design? And then, you know, we'll talk a little bit about the execution in a moment. But so what was your aim and function of the trial and what you wanted to show and why this was important?
Yeah, I'll just try to be succinct here, but try to lay the context. So as we all know, heart failure, which is the disease of interest for us in our trial that we're talking about, is a major public health challenge. It affects over 6 million Americans. It has a high burden of morbidity and mortality. And the good thing is that we have evidence-based therapies, multiple classes of guideline recommended medical therapies that can improve outcomes in patients with heart failure substantially if they're all taken together. There are broadly four classes that are currently recommended: beta blockers, renin-angiotensin system inhibitors, SGLT2 inhibitors, and mineralocorticoid receptor antagonists. And there has been research existing for the last 2-3 decades that have shown that these classes are really effective, and when they're used together, they can reduce all-cause mortality by over 50% compared to conventional two-drug therapy, for example. However, the biggest challenge in management of heart failure in the current era is utilization of these guideline-recommended medical therapies, and only less than 15% of patients who are hospitalized with heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, where your heart function is less than 50%, are actually on guideline-directed medical therapy. And the optimal dosing achievement is even less common. And we know that this matters because several evidence that have come out recently have shown that the sooner we can get our patients on the right classes of medications at the right doses, the better their outcomes are. So our study was trying to address this core question of how can we improve use of evidence-based therapies for heart failure? How can we address some of the barriers? And there are two major broad barriers that we see: provider level barriers and patient level barriers. From provider level barrier, there is a therapeutic inertia. There's just not enough times a patient sees a doctor in clinic after heart failure hospitalization. So there are systemic challenges. And at the patient level barrier, a lot of these patients are older, they have other comorbidities, and they have a high burden of polypharmacy where they are taking multiple drugs. And these medications have complex dosing regimens. So it really becomes challenging to titrate it and to take it on a day-to-day basis for long periods of time. And to this end, a polypill concept, which is not unique, and it basically combines multiple medications into a single pill or capsule, is a promising strategy. It has been shown to be effective in conditions like hypertension management and HIV, and also more recently for secondary prevention of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, but it had never been evaluated for heart failure patients, and where the outcomes are really contingent on how adherent and how effective we are with administering the multi-class guideline-directed medical therapies. So we conducted a randomized controlled trial to evaluate whether a polypill-based strategy can improve outcomes in patients with heart failure. And we were focusing on cardiac structure and function, so left ventricular ejection fraction improvement, but also looking at clinical outcomes of heart failure hospitalization and mortality in patients with heart failure and reduced ejection fraction.
Yeah, very good. And I appreciate you. And I think I provided, when I talked about this before HA, some of the similar context that you mentioned about, you know, polypill strategies have not been new. We've done this in hypertension. And like you said, there's been a ton of prevention-based trials looking at items that are polypills. You know, you see a little bit more of that uptake in the hypertension space, haven't seen widespread use of that elsewhere. One of the commentaries I made, and this is maybe my opinion, I'm just curious what your thoughts are. Do you think, you know, before we ended up with this four pillars and the concept of people being titrated up quickly and starting therapies at the same time, do you think this strategy would have worked 5 to 10 years ago, or people would have been bought into this type of strategy in heart failure?
Yeah, I do think the four class therapy has been there for at least 5-6 years. And then before that, I think there were only three classes, ACE inhibitors, beta blockers, and MRA. I think it would have worked. I think the challenge to use of polypill has been a lot of what is process level challenges, more than whether or not the drugs are effective if taken together. I think the process of how do you get polypills to patients, how can you uptitrate the dosing when each medication needs to be up-titrated. And so I think a lot of the challenges are more process-based, and we'll talk about today. Exactly. Now we are better prepared to address those challenges than we were maybe 10 years ago.
But I guess one of the things I was maybe getting to is the way we manage heart failure, to me, is different than maybe beyond 10 years ago. And I just suspect that people might not have bought onto a polypill process, you know, maybe compared to what we're doing now.
That's true. The strong HF trial only came out recently that showed that early simultaneous initiation of these therapies and rapid uptitration is feasible and very effective. So I think there was lack of literature on whether do we need to get these patients on all four classes and all high doses quickly, or do we have time and we have to do one drug at a time slowly. So I think there was less evidence that this can be done safely as well.
Sure.
So you are right that if you look at now, I think there's much more consensus in the community about the urgency and the rapid scaling up of these therapies in patients.
Very good. So can you also speak a little bit in your design, and maybe you'll talk about this when you talk about the results, but there a little bit of this function was to address social determinants. You really did some targeting work in towards of specific populations. Can you speak to that?
Yeah. So just for context, the burden of adverse outcomes in heart failure are much worse in underserved and socially disadvantaged communities. Patients of self-reported Black race or patients with low income status tend to have much worse outcomes, more frequent hospitalizations. So I think our study was target and the challenges with medication adherence, challenges with having being on the right therapies is also more magnified in this socially disadvantaged patient population. So our study was targeting patients who seek care at Safety Net Hospital in Dallas, Texas, Parkland Hospital, where I work, where I train. And we recruited predominantly socially disadvantaged patient population. And when I get to the results, you'll see that. But in general, I'll tell you like from our baseline characteristics of the study population, which was around 212 patients, more than 50% were self-reported African-Americans, around 30%, more than 30% were Hispanic ethnicity, and around 20% were primary language Spanish speakers. So we did have a substantial proportion of patients who were generally in the socially disadvantaged demographics.
Yep, very good. So now we want to translate or to kind of speak to what you guys ended up finding with the study and the results. And I think it's a very positive trial, in my opinion, and very exciting.
Yeah, I can start with the study result findings because that's kind of the key to our success of this approach. So we tested this polypill approach in 212 patients who were treated with polypill versus enhanced usual care of giving these individual drug classes as separate pills for 6 months. Primary outcome was ejection fraction improvement by cardiac MRI. Secondary outcome were adherence or adherence to the classes of meds as assessed by measuring blood concentration of two of the four meds. And the polypill included three of the four classes, metoprolol, spironolactone, and SGLT2 inhibitors. The fourth class, which is usually angiotensin system blockade, most commonly used on guideline recommendations, and Entresto, which is twice a day, and we did not put in the polypill because we wanted the polypill to be once a day. So what we saw for our primary outcome was that there was a significant improvement in ejection fraction by over 3 points. There was a significant reduction in the secondary outcomes of heart failure hospitalization or ED visits for heart failure by over 60%. And adherence assessed by blood concentration of metoprolol and spironolactone was also significantly higher in the polypill arm as compared to the usual care arm. And polypill was well tolerated, very few adverse events and very few discontinuation episodes were noted. So overall, we saw that polypill was a feasible, well-tolerated, and led to meaningful improvements in ejection fraction as well as in the risk of heart failure hospitalization or ED visits for heart failure.
Yeah. And, you know, especially to your point that you just alluded to around the process with social determinants, that, you know, in theory, from an implementation perspective, is a solution or help bridge some of that gap to do that work, correct?
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think it did, we did also do like a qualitative focus group study to get feedback and get the perspective of patients and their caregivers. And we saw that there was a lot of appetite for this kind of approach, which makes the care easier. And patients identified the polypill as their heart pill, as the pill that helps their heart get better, and anchored on it for and were willing to take it and were very enthusiastic about continuing to be on it, even when we had to stop the study after 6 months.
Well, that's amazing. So right there, even alone, just even from an education or recognition standpoint or, you know, combining that to that one pill made it, you know, more uptake. And I think your adherence was pretty high with that, correct?
Yeah, the adherence was pretty good. And I think what we saw was like at least in 79% of patients in the polypill arm, we were able to detect it after with serum drug testing compared to like 49% in the control arm. So we did see high levels of adherence with this.
That's impressive.
So now let's talk about the processes things. And this is where Nick comes in. And in both of your collaboration, what I think is beautiful with this is it's clearly something people could be doing today. So, you know, when I first heard this process, I'm like, he must have had to really work hard with the FDA and the manufacturers to get this poly pill because there's products from different groups. And I, when I saw you at the meeting, I'm like, how did you do this? And you're like, well, this is what we did. And I'm like, that's fascinating. So do you want to speak to either one of you or how this whole process worked and what this could mean for people being able to actually trying to implement this or their own practice and community?
Yeah, I think we were basing our study design on a previous encapsulation-based polypill trial for hypertension that was published by my co-PI on this study, Dr. Tommy Wang from Vanderbilt. And in that study also, they had used an encapsulation-based approach. So because we are taking the three individual component pills and putting it in a capsule, it's not really something that is changing the morphology or the biochemical content of the individual therapies. So we got an FDA IND exemption as these medications are guideline indicated, and it's more of an implementation strategy than creating a new drug. And once we got an FDA IND exemption, we had to find a suitable partner pharmacy that can actually compound and create those encapsulation-based polypills. And once we had that, I think the rest was mainly just execution of the trial, because we were able to circumvent a lot of the regulatory challenges by not changing the constitution of the individual pill components and not crushing it or mixing it with any other compound.
Okay. And so what was that? And maybe this is where Nick comes in. What was that application process? And I think from my understanding, the way you explained it to me is you guys have essentially cleared the way for anybody to be able to do this process, is my understanding.
Yeah, I think so. We submitted our study protocol and we submitted our rationale and the three pills that we are combining into the capsule and basically made a case why this does not, basically why this is going to be effective, why this should work, and how this is not different at a biochemical or a PKPD, a pharmacokinetic hemodynamic standpoint from what patients do on a day-to-day basis. And I think based on the review, I think FDA did grant us an IND exemption. And we have subsequently got an FDA IND exemption for a polypill for acute coronary syndrome, for diabetes. So not something that is just for one condition, but more like as a strategy. So I think there is a precedence, there is a path forward to use this. At least when we have done it, we have been really successful with it.
And so, but I guess what I'm hearing is because you got this clearance, it is actually, and maybe Nick can help me clarify this from a legal standpoint or something to that piece. This means that any hospital pharmacy or compounding group could take the same concept if they have a pill capsule. And Nick, you can most certainly chime in on the exact process that you guys did to compound these. But what I'm hearing, or what I think I heard you tell me a few weeks ago, is that, you know, if I here at my institution wanted to devise a polypill process for my patients, I could do that because it's already been approved and covered.
I think you may have to do an expedited application if you're doing it on the research setting. I think we still need to figure out for if we're doing it widely for clinical use, what would that look like? But if you're doing it under research setting, you can do it fairly quickly under a protocol. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So did they tell you how you could do it in a non-research setting or not? I'm
sorry. Maybe I think that's something we are working with for the next phase of broader implementation. But I think that's something that still is being, I think, worked out. And Nick, feel free to chime in because I think you probably have more experience with this outside of our study.
From a compounding perspective, what does this mean?
Sure.
And how did you do all this? So, yeah.
Yeah, sure. I'm happy to kind of pull back the curtain on some of that. So Dr. Pandey first approached our pharmacy in probably 2021 at the beginning of this process. And one of the very first questions that we had to get an answer to collaboratively is this product, is it a compound? Or is it something where we're just simply masking commercially available drugs? And so if we were going to see in a perfect world, Craig, what we would do from my biased compounding perspective would be we could take these pure drugs in their API form, right, in their pure powder form, and we could compound them using those pure powders in exactly the dose that the doctor requested, like we do on a day-to-day basis for our normal outpatient prescriptions, right? But when you add the wrinkle of the regulatory agencies and the research protocols to this, you know, no compound is FDA approved. And so rarely is that the path of least resistance, right, in one of these trials. And so one of the things that Dr. Pandey and I first worked through was how do we get these commercially available products combined together in a way that is going to not really classify what we're doing as a compound. And so the process that we use is just called over-encapsulation, which is pretty self-explanatory, right? And so we procured the commercially available products and basically put them inside a larger pill, right? And it sounds very, very simple, and in concept it is. But some of the things that we had to consider are, you know, manufacturers make different sizes of tablets. One of the products, you know, the Jardiance, was brand name only. And so there were some financial implications to that. And it made it a little bit more, there's a little bit more bureaucratic red tape that we had to go through as far as just the financial side of it was concerned. You know, the metoprolol and spironolactone are
cheap. Pretty generic, yeah.
Right.
So would that be a process where you would like get the individual components approved on the patient's insurance, or were you guys using bulk product? Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so in this particular trial, Dr. Pandey and I had this discussion early on as well, as that idea was floated around of, you know, could we fill this essentially as a patient specific prescription, bill the patient's insurance. That is, I suppose, technically feasible, but it adds a multitude of variables to this. You know, what if someone requires a prior authorization? What if they don't come pick up the capsule? How is the investigator able to, you know, track compliance that way? And so the strategy we ultimately decided upon was using the investigational drug service at his institution to dispense the product. And we essentially filled it as a clinical trial use order. And so theoretically, you could do that. And maybe that is the path forward on the next phase of this study. But for our purposes, in order to keep everything as controlled as possible, we elected to just let the investigational drug service at the institution dispense the product to the patient.
Gotcha. Very good. And so obviously what it looks like for you and us thinking about it as pharmacists, you are having to think about the size and scope, not just the cost of the things, but the size and scope of each pill and putting that into an appropriate size capsule. And so it just, for us pharmacists, and I know that Dr. Pandey knows this, what size capsule size were you ending up putting these products in?
Yeah. So that was the biggest barrier in this particular study was just a matter of mass, right? The largest treatment arm, you had metoprolol, you know, extended release, 150 milligrams were required as one in one of the treatment groups. And so that is a lot of drug to fit inside a capsule, especially when you're combining it with, you know, a Jardiance and then a spironolactone tablet as well.
Right.
And so the way that we solve that problem is there's a line of capsules that's made by a company called Capsigel. And they have atypical sizes that are used in investigational settings. The line is called a DB cap, like a double blind cap. And the size that we used was actually a size AAA. So that involved us getting a special capsule machine, and of course, ordering these capsules to be able to do it. It kind of, to give a visual, it kind of looks like a Boston baked bean, you know, those candies. That's about what it looks like. And so that's one of the areas of improvement. And we were kind of limited in this particular trial, I would say, just because of the drugs that were involved and the release mechanism of the metoprolol. You know, we couldn't crush anything due to the extended release. On the subsequent polypill trials, we've actually been able to reduce those down into a size double aught capsule, which is much more reasonable. But even with the larger AAA capsule, I think especially to the listener, knowing that we use this larger capsule and then you still see the compliance numbers and adherence rates that Dr. Pandey and the team observed, I think it makes the results all the more impressive, because you certainly could hopefully improve this a little bit. You know, there would be a way to manufacture a product down the road that has these three agents in it and reduce the size of the capsule. But for us, kind of at the initiation of this, we were limited by not breaking down those commercial products. And so anyway, that's the most impressive part to me, is that even though we're using an atypical size, the patients still were compliant with the medication, and you still saw the, you know, the statistical increases in all the areas that Dr. Pandey described earlier.
Yeah, and I think, and I know you mentioned too, a Boston baked bean size, and I think Dr. Pandey said this, it's very similar to, you know, heart failure patients are used to taking the large potassium pills, right? And so this would be a little bit size-wise or up to that nature, or, you know, the point being they take large pills, so we're used to it.
Right. So so I guess my last question is, so what does this look like from the future for implementation? So, like, and for either you, Nick, or Dr. Renew, how do we eventually get to a polypill strategy? Do we have to wait for industry to allow that to occur, or is this something eventually compounding could help solve?
Well, I can speak from my perspective. Yeah. Certainly it's something that's possible. You know, the beautiful thing about this idea and this trial is that it is simple. I mean, it's ingenious, and the execution and implementation of it, once all the pieces are in place, is very, I mean, I hate to use the word easy, but it's not a complicated thing to do. And so, from my perspective, I'm happy to share, any of my knowledge that anybody wanted. I'm happy to divulge that with, Pandey's permission, of course. But you know, that it really is, there's not a lot of barriers to being able to execute this in a setting outside of mine on a day-to-day basis.
I guess it's just eventually, how would you do it in a non-research setting is maybe what I am trying to get towards.
Yeah, I think that's the million-dollar question, Craig, is what next in terms of taking it to patients on a routine basis? And I think there is still work that needs to be done. I think at the end of the day, we did this study at a single center using expert help from Nick and his company. I think we have since then, as I was telling you earlier, explored this and across different conditions, and also using our own hospital pharmacy and getting the compound, the encapsulation machine in our pharmacy and doing it. And it's all very feasible and doable. And I think a lot of it ultimately comes down to setting processes in place for implementation to improve specific patient outcomes or patients' ease of taking medicine. There is less of a, I think, legal or a regulatory challenge, because ultimately this is not viewed as creating a new pill or compounding a new drug. It's viewed as basically no different from like a blister pack that people use for pills or a pill pack, right? So I think that makes it a little bit easier to scale up. But we still need to show that this can be done in an effective manner across diverse kinds of health systems, using pharmacies that health systems work with and using insurance-based models. We did have a lot of flexibility in our polypill. We could uptitrate doses. We had different versions. Metoprolol dose could be uptitrated from like 25 to I think from 35 to 150, I believe. So there is a lot of flexibility, and I think a lot of the innovation will happen at the pharmacy end. So when they receive the prescription for a patient, they are able to basically figure out how many pills and go into the polypill and then create it, and dispensing, instead of three bottles, they can dispense one bottle. So I think that's kind of how I see the scalability of it. And we are going to do a phase 3 trial of the polypill for heart failure and other things. So hopefully we'll get to know more of and learn from our experience as we scale up this kind of work.
Yep. And so just last question. So your pharmacy is doing this. Are you doing this in a non-research environment now?
No, we haven't done this for non-research setting yet.
Okay. Gotcha. Okay. And last question, just either one of you, we always ask non-clinical questions to make people feel that we're all human beings. Any good books, TV shows, movies, things that you've recently read or watched that you would recommend?
Yeah, I think recently I watched the TV show. I think I watch a lot of investigational crime drama on Netflix. So I watched His and Hers. It's really good. It's based on a book.
Yes, I've heard about this.
Yeah, and it's a really good crime drama that I recently completed. Off the top of my head, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. For you.
And for me, what I've, if not quite as exciting, is what I'm currently reading is the Illinois Pharmacy Practice Act and Controlled Substance Laws, because I'm going to be taking the Illinois MPJE law exam next Tuesday. I've got licenses in 13 states, and Illinois just passed a law that's gone into effect that you have to have a pharmacy. You know, we have a pharmacy license in Illinois, but now your PIC has to have a pharmacist license too. And so I've been getting up to speed on the Illinois pharmacy law. So very, very exciting.
Okay. Very good. That is perfect. I appreciate all your time, and thank you for sharing and joining us today. If you guys like this content, let us know. Like the episode, like the show, send us feedback, comments. But thank you both for being here. And that will be all. Y'all, everyone, have a good one until the next time. Thank you.
Thanks for having us. Thank you. Yep.